America has gone.
Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, Janet Napolitano, at an interview, February 26, 2013.
What we've spent the past 4 years doing is putting in place is something completely different, an approach that's more efficient, risk-based, and designed to detect, prevent, and respond to a range of threats, from terrorist attacks to natural disasters. This approach is built upon the notion that in a world of evolving threats, we can no longer be simply reactive or isolated. We have to leverage information to identify threats sooner, target our security measures to areas where they will have the greatest impact in decreasing risk, allocate our resources according to risk-based priorities.
Not 7 weeks after Janet Napolitano's interview, where she spoke of a new approach, being more efficient, risk-based, and being able to detect and prevent terrorism. April 15th, at the finish line of the Boston Marathon. To another episode of America Akbar. I'm your host, Gadi Edelman. And with me tonight, as usual, the one, the only... Okay, Risa, you don't have to say anything because I know you didn't want to be on air tonight because you have a headache. Okay, so don't say anything. But you were right because the music did not start on its own.
Oh, my God. Mark the calendar. Oh, my goodness. Gadi just said, Reese was right. That's a miracle.
It's not the first time. All right, well, just for that, let me introduce the other sidekick that's become an appendage to my appendage. So without further ado, the music for the man. Let's see here.
Here I come to save the day. That means that Mighty Mouse is on the way. Yes, sir, when there is a wrong to right,
when there is a wrong to right, we have Rabbi Ariel Nachman. How you doing, Rabbi?
I'm still trying to figure out whether the song says Mighty Mouse or Mighty Mouth.
Well, you know, take it for what it's worth. It's an old recording.
Either way, it works for me.
Hey, it works for me, too. How are you, Rabbi?
I'm doing good.
Well, then don't start coughing. I'm glad to see that your puppy is doing better.
Yes, she is. She's been up and around and putting some weight on her leg and doing pretty good.
Well, I'll tell you what. I was tempted, although I didn't, I was tempted to put up photos of my scars on Facebook, since you put in pictures of your doggy scars.
I guess it all depends on what scars they are. If they're your hernia scars, I don't want to see them.
There you go. So it's a lot worse than a hernia scar. But anyway, So welcome, everybody. Welcome to everybody in the chat room. And we are, like, right on time and have nothing to talk about because it's been such a slow news week. We might as well just call it quits. Oh, my God. We actually have a lot to cover tonight. But before we get started, let me give out our phone number. As we always do, introduce Mr. Trade Martin with the phone number.
Area code 347-857-1380.
857-1380, 347-857-1380. And if you want to Skype in, you can Skype in from the top right-hand corner if you're on your computer. I don't know if it works if you're on your smartphone, but what the hell, give it a shot. So, anyway, pardon me. I figured, Rabbi, that to start off the evening, we should just play the new game out there called Let's Pronounce That Name. Because now we have three new arrests in Boston.
Yep.
So let's see how we do here. You've got, I can get the first name, Diaz. That's pretty good. Diaz. Kabyarabeyev. Yes. Call your Kabyarabeyev. And then you've got Azmat, not to be confused with Hazmat. You've got Azmat Tazakov. That one's not too bad. And Robel Filipos. Filipos. I don't know if he's Filipino, but he's Filipos. And then, of course, you've got the two bombers. Now, and let me tell everybody, I know the guy's name is spelled D-Z-H-O-K-H-A-R. I have heard this name pronounced more ways than you can imagine just watching the news stations that I watch, because I do watch more than one channel. And it cracks me up all the different ways they are pronouncing his first name. It's not Zokar. It's not Zakar. It's nothing with a K in it at all. If anybody would pay attention, when I say anybody, I'm referring to these so-called experts, pundits, and news people. There was an interview, more than one out there, with all of his friends. And they all said that he said to call him, and I quote, Jahar, which is an Arabic name, Jahar. I know how it's spelled. That's the Russian spelling. The man's name is Jahar. So you got Jahar Tsarnev and, of course, his brother Tamerlan. And interestingly enough, if I remember right, Rabbi, and I don't know if you heard this, one of their names in, I believe it's Tamerlan, is actually named after the person that was the liberator, if you will, of Chechnya, of that particular area. And he was a terrorist himself. And then the other one is named after Jahar, which I believe comes from, it has something to do with jihad. Gee, what a shocker. So
amazing.
You've got one named after the rebel from Chechnya and the other one named after jihad. So is it any wonder that they grew up to be the way they did?
Who would have figured?
Sorry, I was lighting a cigarette. Yes, Gotti smokes. Bad habit. I'm sorry, but I kind of threw it to the rabbi there, and he didn't pick up on that. Rabbi, when you do that, you're supposed to say something. Anyway, so have you been?
I will endeavor to do better.
Ah, well, thank you, sir. I know that you're going to Rabbis Anonymous, but. So, yes, we're going to talk about Kabyarabeyev, Tazakov, and Filipos later in the program, along with Jahar and his brother Tamerlan, as we touch on different things. But the last thing I want to do, as you guys know, is be like every other news station out there, because all I've seen all week is about Boston. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't have a problem seeing anything about Boston. I'm glad that they're putting it out there. It's the way they're putting it out there that ticks me off. But there's a couple of different things I wanted to do tonight. And before we get started, and before it gets any later, let us introduce Jonathan David from Jerusalem with the Israel Today News Update.
Reporting from the Israel Today newsroom for American Akbar with Gadi Edelman. From Jerusalem, I'm Jonathan David. members of the opposition and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's own coalition are pressing the Israeli leader to accept a new Arab peace proposal as a basis for renewed negotiations with the Palestinians. Earlier this week, Qatar's Prime Minister referenced the Saudi-authored Arab League peace initiative while visiting Washington. He seemed to suggest a softening of the proposal's conditions, stating that the Arabs were ready to accept comparable mutually agreed and minor land swaps between Israel and a future Palestinian state. Israeli officials hailed the remarks as an opportunity for peace. Netanyahu responded on Wednesday by reminding officials at the foreign ministry that the conflict is not actually about land and borders, but rather about Israel's existence. As Netanyahu noted, Israel was under attack for nearly two decades before it captured the so-called occupied territories in 1967. And when Israel tried to unilaterally surrender the Gaza Strip in 2005, the move resulted in increased terrorism. That being said, Netanyahu concluded that in order to avoid a binational state in which Arabs outnumber Jews, Israel must reach an agreement that results in the creation of a Palestinian Arab state. The ruling party of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas's Fatah faction, praised Tuesday's murder of a Jewish man by a knife-wielding Palestinian terrorist. The victim was a husband and father of five young children whose only crime was being a Jew living in an area the world says Jews cannot live, the biblical hills of Samaria. The international community holds Abbas and Fatah aloft as moderate forces in the region. But one must wonder, would the world likewise view it as moderation if Israel's ruling Likud party openly praised a Jew who murdered an unarmed Arab? From Jerusalem, this is Jonathan David inviting you to sign up for your free newsletter at IsraelToday.com.
And I just noticed that he ended that broadcast a little bit differently than usual, because he usually says, stay informed, pray informed, and then he gives their web address. But anyway, thank you, Jonathan David. That was this morning's news from Israel, and of course it's middle of the night over there right now. But a couple of the things that he mentioned during that, there's something I want to read before we get started. And we're going to get into the news about the individual that was stabbed and everything else. But he was talking about the peace initiative. And for those who don't know who Carolyn Glick is, Rabbi, I'm sure you know who Carolyn Glick is.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, Carolyn Glick, I'm going to give a brief there's no such thing as a brief bio when it comes to the people that I choose to talk about on the show. She grew up in Chicago's ultra-liberal, anti-American, and anti-Israel stronghold of Hyde Park. She made Aliyah to Israel in 1991. 2 weeks after receiving her bachelor's in political science from Columbia University, she joined the Israeli Defense Forces that summer and served as an officer for 5.5 years in the IDF. From 1994 through 1996, as an IDF captain, she served as coordinator of negotiations with the PLO in the Office of the Coordinator of Government Activities of Judea, Samaria, and Gaza. She was a core member of Israel's negotiating team with the Palestinians. After leaving the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, at the end of 1996, she worked as the assistant to the Director General of the Israel Antiquities Authority. She then returned to politics, serving as assistant foreign policy advisor to now Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu through 1997 and 1998. From 98 to 2000, she went back to the United States, where she received her master's degree in public policy from Harvard's University Kennedy School of Government in June of 2000. In the summer of 2000, she returned to Israel and began writing at the Hebrew newspaper Makor Rishon. She served as chief diplomatic commentator and edited magazine supplements on strategic issues, for the Makor Rishon newspaper until March 2002. In March 2002, she became the deputy managing editor of the Jerusalem Post. At the Post, she wrote two weekly columns. Now, during Operation Iraqi Freedom, she covered the war in Iraq as an embedded journalist with the U.S. Army's 3rd Infantry Division. She was reporting for the Jerusalem Post, the other Israeli Hebrew newspaper Ma'ariv, Israel TV's Channel 2, and the Chicago Sun-Times. She was one of the only female journalists on the front lines with the U.S. forces, and she was the first Israeli journalist to report from liberated Baghdad. Her writings have been published in the Wall Street Journal, the National Review, the Journal of International Security Affairs, the Boston Globe, the Washington Times, the Jewish Press, Front Page Magazine, and Moment Magazine, and numerous online journals that focus on the strategic and political issues challenging Israel and the United States. She's appeared on MSNBC, Fox News, Sky News, Christian Broadcast Network, Israel Television Channels 1, 2, 3, and 10, and is a frequent guest on talk radio shows in the U.S., Britain, Australia, and Israel. She's now the She's now the Senior Fellow for Middle Eastern Affairs at the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., and she travels several times a year to Washington to brief senior administration officials and members of Congress on the joint Israeli-American concern. In Israel's Independence Day supplement in 2003, the Hebrew newspaper Ma'ariv named her the most prominent woman in Israel. In December 2005, she was awarded the Ben Hecht Award for Middle East Reporting from the Zionist Organization of America. And in January 2006, she was awarded the Abramovitz Prize for Media Criticism by Israel Media Watch. In 2008, in her first solo book, Shackled Warrior, Israel and the Global Jihad, was published, and she currently lives in Jerusalem. Now that I've read this young lady's bio, which is phenomenal, and the only other person I can think of that has a bio like that, where I cut that down a little bit, is Waleed Feres. Now that I've read her bio, I want to read an article that she wrote, more of an op-ed, not an article. And I wanted you to understand all the different things she had done. This girl was, you know, as I mentioned, at the core of being one of Israel's negotiators with the Palestinians during the peace process. She served with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. She served as a captain for 5 years in the Israeli Defense Forces. She knows what she's talking about when it comes to the issues facing Israel and the so-called possibility of peace. So I want to read this column that just was in the other day. So I'm going to read this. Oh, and by the way, so everybody knows, she and I have spoken by email, and we're trying to work out when I'm going to have her on the program, because she would be one hell of a guest. But anyway, as Independence Day celebrations were winding down last Tuesday night, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made a guest appearance on Channel 2's left-wing satire show, Eretz Nederet. One of the final questions that the show's host, Eyal Kitzitz, asked the premier was how he would like to be remembered after he leaves office. Netanyahu thought for a moment and said, quote, "I'd like to be remembered as the leader who preserved Israel's security," end quote. On the face of it, Netanyahu's stated aspiration might seem dull. In a year, he'll be the longest-serving prime minister in the state's history, and all he wants is to preserve our national security. Why is he aiming so low? And yet, the studio audience reacted to Netanyahu's modest goal with a thunderclap of applause. After pausing to gather his thoughts, a clearly befuddled host, Kitzitz, mumbled something along the lines of, "Well, if you manage to make peace as well, we wouldn't object." Then the audience became silent. The disparity between the audience's exhalation and Kitzitz's shocked disappointment at Netanyahu's answer exposed yet again the yawning gap between the mainstream Israeli view of the world and that shared by members of our elite class. The Israeli public gave our elites the opportunity to try out their peace fantasies back in the 1990s. We gave their peace a chance, and we got repaid with massive terror and international isolation. We are not interested in repeating the experience. We will be nice to the leftists if they are polite. We might even watch their shows, if there's nothing else on, or if they're even mildly entertaining, but we won't listen to them anymore. This is why U.S. President Barack Obama's visit last month had no impact on public opinion or government policy. Obama came hugged Netanyahu, and showered us with love just like Bill Clinton did back in the roaring 90s. He praised us to high heaven and told us he has our back. And then he told us we should force our leaders to give Jerusalem, Judea, and Samaria to our sworn enemies, even as they teach their children to aspire to kill our children. And we smiled, and we wished him a pleasant flight home. Obama had no idea what he was getting into when he came here. Like the show host Kitsis and his colleagues on Channel 2, Obama surrounds himself with people who, like him, prefer fantasy to reality. In Obama's world, Islamic jihad is about the West, not about jihadists. In Obama's world, the most pressing issue on the international agenda is the apartments for Jews in Jerusalem and Efrat. And in Obama's world, what Israel needs more than anything else is for the leftist Europeans to love us. Talk about being retro. But a lot has changed since the 1990s. 20 years after Yitzhak Rabin shook Yasser Arafat's hand on the White House lawn and so officially ushered in Israel's age of terror, most Israelis don't really care what the Europeans or the Arabs think of us. The Europeans prattle on about Israeli racism and threaten to put yellow stars or some other nasty mark on Israeli goods and products. They ban Israeli books from their libraries in Scotland. They boycott Israeli universities, professors, and students in England. In Italy, they hold rallies for convicted mass murderer Marwan Barghouti at their national senate. And in France, they butcher Jewish children. And then the likes of Catherine Ashton expect us to care what they think about. Well, we don't. For their part, Americans are bemoaning the resignation of the unelected Palestinian Prime Minister Salim Fayyad and insisting that he was a true partner for Israel who just couldn't make a go of it due to forces beyond his control. What most recognize Fayyad's departure has nothing to do with Israel. Some U.S. pontificators have blamed Israel for Fayyad's failure. Elliot Abrams, for instance, wrote, "Israeli governments also gave him less cooperation than he deserved." To that we answer, Fayyad was nothing more than a Western delusion like Arab peace with Israel. Fayyad didn't have a chance of leading the Palestinians because he never personally killed a Jew. And the Palestinians only accept murderers as their leaders. But the fact that he never killed a Jew personally didn't render Fayyad a partner for Israel. Fayyad dutifully used donor funds to pay for the salaries of terrorists in Judea, Samaria, and Gaza every month. He led the Palestinian branch of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions war against Israel. He made working for Israelis and buying Israeli goods criminal offenses. Fayyad personally led raids into private homes to inspect people's refrigerators to see if they had Israeli cottage cheese on their shelves. He organized and attended bonfires where they burned Israeli goods. Not to put too fine a point on it, but this is not the sort of behavior you would expect a peace partner to engage in. The Americans who insist on mourning Fayyad's departure refuse to accept the obvious fact that the Palestinian aspirations for statehood are cheap, shoddy, for export-only Arab product. The Palestinians don't want a state. They want to destroy Israel. Unable to accept this basic fact, the Americans invent lies like Fayyad is a peace partner and try to shove them down Israel's throats. Well, good riddance, Salam Fayyad. Obviously, Fayyad is not the last word in Western delusion. They will think of a new perfect solution to replace him in short order. But in their endless search for the next silver bullet, the Europeans and the Americans and their Israeli followers miss the fact that the easiest way to build a secure and peaceful world is not by wooing terrorists. The best way to achieve these goals is by accepting the world as it is. This is what the Israeli people have done. True, we need to have our fantasies blown away in suicide bombings before we reconciled ourselves to this simple truth. But life has been better, happier, and more secure since we did. The international community's inability to accept that sober-minded contentment is better than pipe dream fantasies has caused the leftist writers in Israel, Europe, and the U.S. alike to express mystification at a recent survey carried out by the OECD, which ranks Israelis among the happiest people in the world. The ranking made no sense to the commentators. Israelis work harder than other members of the OECD. We complain more than other members of the OECD. We don't have peace, and yet we're among the happiest people in the OECD. What gives? For decades before we embarked on the phony peace process, Israel was a modelist social state. We had paralyzing tax rates and a failed government with industries that crowded private and entrepreneurship out of the market. Monopolies ran every sector and provided shoddy goods and horrible services at astronomical prices. The Histadrut labor union owned most of the economy, along with the government, in every sector. And the Histadrut commissioners ensured that anyone with an ounce of initiative was subject to unending abuse. But then came Nirvana. Just around the time we began extricating ourselves from our socialist straitjacket, we were also recognizing that the peace thing wasn't everything it was cracked up to be. And that at that point, we began to understand that happiness and success aren't about what other people give you. Monies, treaties, a phone line after a five-year wait. Happiness and success are about what you accomplish. At that point, sometime between 1996 and 2000, Israelis began creating large families and embracing the free market. Today, with an average of 3 children per family, Israelis are the outliners of the industrial world. And as David Goldman at PJ Media has demonstrated, there is a direct correlation between children and human happiness. This is why fruitful Israelis have the lowest suicide rate in the world. When you have children, you have a future. And when you have a future, you work hard to secure it and have a generally optimistic outlook. What could be so bad when your kid just lost his first tooth? Israelis are also happy because we see that we can build the future that we want for our families and our country even without another glitzy signing ceremony at the White House every 6 months. Our country is getting stronger and more livable every day, and we know it. Those on the international stage that share our view of life is about more than just pieces of paper signed with an Arab anti-Semite recognizing what is happening. For them, Israel is not that shitty little country. It's the engine that could. Take the Chinese. Last July, China signed a deal with Israel to build an inland port in Eilat and a 180-kilometer freightway to connect Eilat to Israel's Mediterranean ports in Ashdod and Haifa. The purpose of this project is to build an alternative to the Suez Canal in Israel. The Chinese look at the region and they see that Egypt is a failed state that can't even afford its wheat imports. The future of shipping along the Suez Canal is in doubt, with riots in Port Said and the Suez occurring on a regular basis. But on the other hand, Israel is a stable, prosperous, successful democracy that keeps moving from strength to strength. When the freight line is completed, as far as the global economy is concerned, Israel will become the most strategically important country in the region. Then there's our newfound energy wealth. Israel became energy independent on March 30th when the Tamar offshore gas field began pumping natural gas to Israel. In 2 to 3 years, when the Levathan gas field comes online, Israel would become one of the most important producers of natural gas in the world. Moreover, in 2017, Israel will likely begin extracting commercial quantities of oil from its massive oil shale deposits in Shaphlaya Basin near Beit Shemesh. Geologists assess that the field alone contains some 250 billion barrels of oil, giving Israel the parity with Saudi Arabia, Chinese, Russian, and Australian firms are already lining up to sign contracts with Israeli energy companies. International analysts assess that Israel's emergence as an energy power will have a stabilizing impact on the global economy and international security. Israel can end Asia's oil and gas hunger, it can reduce European dependency on Russia, and it will remove OPEC's ability to dictate world oil prices through supply manipulation. Israel's discovery of its energy riches couldn't have come at a more prosperous time. Israel had Israel discovered its oil and gas 65 or even 20 years ago, we wouldn't have had the economic maturity to manage our resources responsibly. But now, with our free market, our high-tech sector, and our entrepreneurial culture, we can develop and manage our resources wisely and successfully. At 65, Israel is becoming a mature, responsible, prosperous, and powerful player in the international arena. The only thing we need to ensure that we enjoy the fruits of our labors is security. And the one thing we can do to squander it, all of it, in place of our hopes, is peace. And so we won't, ever again. If you want to read that, you can go to Carol, and I'm going to post it in the chat room, carolinglick.com, if you'd like to read it rather than hearing me read it to you, especially with my little interruptions. But
that's amazing.
She manages to hit every nail on the head about how Israel realized after the 1990s, after we saw Arafat, and you know, first it wasn't even Arafat. Let's go back to Anwar Sadat and Carter and Begin. Then we saw Arafat and Shimon Peres and Clinton on the White House lawn, and she talked about the glitzy White House ceremonies, and every time Israel did that, they ended up with more terrorism. They ended up with more bombings. They ended up with more deaths. They ended up with more isolation from the rest of the world. And if you look back at history, she is so absolutely right. This is coming from a woman who worked in the political arena for the Israeli government as an advisor to Benjamin Netanyahu, as a core individual with the so-called peace process, saying, forget it. We don't need your peace. We're doing just fine the way we are, and we're not going back there again. And it's something to be said. It really is. What'd you think of that article, Rabbi?
That's absolutely amazing.
I did not know about the shale oil in Israel. I didn't know
I read that. Yeah, I did. I've been keeping an eye on that, and I actually commented on this about a year ago. You know, because we're... And it's all about everything happens in God's time, right?
Yes.
When we talked about the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, and we talked about, you know, the Dead Sea,
mm-hmm.
and there's that pillar there. What is that pillar called? That big, huge pillar of salt there.
The one that keeps changing?
It's called Lot's wife.
Yes.
Okay. Now, when we come back into the land after the Exodus, after 40 years of wandering, we came back into the land. And what was waiting for us in the land? A ready-made source of income to make us independent.
Mm-hmm.
Salt, which was worth more than gold back then. Here again, Israel has come to the point where they're, and she's absolutely right, they have matured to a point that now these things are starting to be discovered, and it is by no accident.
Mm-hmm. The timing.
Timing is everything. But
she's so right about the maturity, you know, and she talks about the socialistic ways and the socialistic government. And for those that didn't understand in that article, when she talked about a 5-year waiting list for a telephone, when I lived in Israel, my family made Aliyah. We moved to Israel in 1975. We got on the phone list because there were no cell phones in 1975. And the telephone system that was in place in Israel at that time was left over from the 1948 British Mandate. And we used to joke, and it was no joke, you could open up your window, scream across the street to your neighbor and have a better hearing conversation with them yelling across the street than if you called them on the phone. And the reason was, the phones, like everything else in that country, because it was a socialist country in its makeup, it was socially democratic, but it was a socialistic country nonetheless. The phone system, like every other major utility, was run by the government, and they weren't putting money into the telephone system. They didn't care about the telephone system. The money went to the military. The money went to survival. So we signed up in 1975 on the waiting list, which at that time was a 12-year waiting list, to get a telephone. When we left Israel, we were still on the waiting list. The entire time I lived in Israel, we did not own a telephone. And I know that
sounds
weird.
And if you moved back there today, you might just be at the top of the list.
You know, that's no joke. You know, thank God. People wonder when we talk about the fact that the cell phone, and I know if you go online and you read about it, they say it was a guy with Motorola in New York and blah, blah, blah. Israel invented the first cell phone. It was Motorola, but it was Motorola Israel. And it's interesting. The reason they did that was because, again, you talk about capitalism. You talk about that entrepreneurship. You know, you had an individual that just got sick and tired of the Israeli phone system who said, you know what, we'll do something different. Well, we're not using phone lines. And they went and invented the cell phone. So this is how things like that happen over there. And now you've got a country, like she said, 20 years ago, they weren't mature enough. Now, you know, who is the number one country besides the United States? Who's the number one country that is on NASDAQ? And that's Israel. There are more startup technological companies coming out of this little teeny tiny country than anywhere else in the world. And this is what people don't realize. And that article really hit the nail on the head. If we try and do peace again, and I say we as an Israeli, if Israel tries to do peace again, they're going to end up right back in the same place. Look at what happened in 2005, a unilateral withdrawal from Gaza. And what happened? It was answered, instead of with peace with Gaza, it was answered with rockets. So, you know, we've seen this going on since then. This is what goes on a regular basis over there. And people
need to know. Yeah, even in Lebanon.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, we pulled out of Lebanon. What happened?
Yeah. And that's another thing. You know, people don't realize, they always talk about the West Bank and Gaza. If Israel were to return to the so-called 1967 lines, which, as I pointed out in my article, 1967 really means 1949, you're talking about the 1949 armistice lines, not the lines that Israel had after the 67 war, because that's where Israel is right now. They're talking about going back to the pre-1967 lines, and it just sounds better to say 1967 than to say 1949. But part of what they captured in 1967 was the Golan Heights. You know, that's part of what would be, if they gave it back, Syria. And part of what would be, if they gave it back, Lebanon. And the Golan Heights are just that. They're mountains. It's a height. And they used to sit up there and just lob missiles and rockets into Israel from on top of the mountain. It's a strategic point that Israel is never going to return. For their own security and survival, they cannot return the Golan Heights. People forget about all these other things. They returned the entire Sinai Desert to Egypt when they made peace with Anwar Sadat, which I might add, in the very beginning, I was against. And I was against it for the reasons that we're seeing now. Because I knew Anwar Sadat wasn't going to live forever. Didn't think he was going to die that soon, but of course he was assassinated by, yeah, you guessed it, the likes of Yasser Arafat and his groups. Who, by the way, Yasser Arafat, that great freedom fighter spokesman, stated the day he signed that, the day he put pen to paper and signed his name on that peace treaty, you just signed your own death warrant. A lot of people don't realize the threats that came out. And that was an exact quote. So, anyway, I wanted to read that article, give people...
I mean, didn't Anwar Sadat actually acknowledge that he had, by signing that, he was signing his own death warrant?
He did. He said that he would probably die by being assassinated. He absolutely did. And he knew. And that, you know, he was an amazing guy. I've written articles about him before. If people want to go to my website at GottiEdelman.com and go through the articles off the top of my head, I don't remember the name of the article. But I specifically wrote one. It was very interesting because when Anwar Sadat made peace with Israel, the prime minister at that time was Menachem Begin. And if you went back to when Israel was fighting for its liberation to become a state, Menachem Begin was a terrorist.
Yep.
I mean, there's you can't deny that. The man was a terrorist. He was part of the Irgun.
Yeah, he actually spent time in Acre Prison, didn't he?
Yes, he did. And yeah. he was the one that blew up the King David Hotel in Jerusalem.
Right, yes.
And so you had, at that time, Anwar Sadat was a terrorist in Egypt bombing Israel, or what was then, you know, Palestine, where the Jews lived. And you had these two former terrorists who were now leaders of their countries sitting and laughing together. And the biggest thing was Golda Meir at that time, who was still alive, Ohev Shalom, may she rest in peace, Golda Meir giving him a gift and him giving her a gift. That would be Anwar Sadat giving Golda Meir a gift. They were trading gifts for their grandchildren. You had two grandparents laughing and smiling, and they really became true friends. And it was just an amazing time. And a lot of people in Israel, including myself, were very worried when he died, when he was assassinated, because we didn't know, number one, if there was going to be a coup, who was going to take over. And when Hosni Mubarak did take over, we didn't know if he would continue with the peace treaty. But he did. And for 33 years, Israel saw peace with them. And now it's all up in, you know, up in the air, and it's in jeopardy because of the Muslim Brotherhood and Morsi.
Yep. Yeah, you know who else was against it?
Every other Arab country out there.
Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson. He said it would not last. It was nothing but a piece of paper. It wouldn't last more than 30 years.
Well, he was wrong on the years, but he was right on the whole thing. I mean, he was darn close. You know, that's the problem with any peace treaty. It's as good as the paper it's written on. It's still a piece of paper.
Yeah.
Why don't we get Reese in here? We'll do our first quick break, and when we come back, we'll start the news, and then that'll give us time to go over everything with, I want to talk about Benghazi, which, of course, we have not forgotten. I've got some audio I want to play, and I want to talk about the Let's Pronounce That Name game from our five lovely individuals in Boston, and explain to everybody this was not Lone Wolf. I know I said it when it happened. I know I called it before anybody else had the gojones to get out there and say it. But we're going to talk about that as well. So, Reese, dearest, you can mumble if you like. I know you don't want to be
well,
on tonight.
I thought, you know what? Michael Tracy has his new album out, and it's in fact, the CD is on its way to my house as we speak.
Sweet.
So I thought we would play. I know I'm excited because I love his music. And, of course, I have the album on my MP3 player, but the CD is always, it has better quality sound, in my opinion. So anyway, without further ado, this is from Michael Tracy's new album. The title song is Red Sky. So here we have Red Sky, Michael Tracy. You can find him at michael-tracy.com.
It's a red sky. We'll be right back.
Welcome, fellow infidels. Gadi Edelman here with America Akbar Radio. If you're only listening to the radio show, you are only getting a small piece of what we do around here. You need to get over to GadiEdelman.com, GadiEdelman.com. There you can read my weekly articles that come out every Monday. You can check out my videos, and you can link up to a bunch of other great sites and really stay on top of things. So once again, for everybody here at America Akbar, keep on listening, and thanks for your support.
Hey everybody, this is Dave Bray of Madison Rising, and you're listening to America Akbar with Gadi Edelman and Reek on Blog Talk Radio.
Back. Thanks everybody for hanging on through the break. Awesome, awesome song there, Reese, with the Michael Tracy. Thank you so much. And welcome back to everybody, and welcome back, Rabbi.
And we're still here.
Are still here. And by the way, Rabbi, I have a question to you. We're going to go totally off track here for one quick second. Am I allowed to use a Pesach Seder plate, for those in the chat room, that would be a Passover serving dish, to put it simply. Am I allowed to use a Pesach Seder plate for things other than Pesach?
No.
Uh-oh.
Once you can. But once you have to recasher it.
Okay, all right.
Which means that you have to make it kosher again. I mean, right. If you go into the typical Haredi home, and that's ultra-Orthodox, you'll find that they have a complete set of dishes for meat, a complete set of dishes for milk, and a complete set of dishes for Passover.
Well, okay, so I have this Seder plate, which was given to me many years ago by my parents, and it's from Israel, of course. We bought it while we were there. And it's Roman glass. And for those that aren't familiar with the Roman glass that comes out of Israel, it's just magnificent. It's like this frosted, it's got all different reds and purples in it, and it's really a beautiful plate. And it's a very large Seder plate, Rabbi. So last night I was entertaining, and I didn't have a big enough dish. So it ended up with a lot of cheese and crackers and apple slices on it, and it wasn't until we ate some that you could really see that it was a Seder plate anyway, so...
Well, in that case, the way to recasher it or to make it kosher again is to simply wash it in soap and water.
Yes. Okay. Unlike my grandmother, who used to stick things in dirt.
that is actually true. The way to kosher a knife
exactly.
is to jab it into the earth 10 times.
Yes. And it was funny because if you went to my grandmother, my Nana, if you went to her house in Philadelphia, you would often see in the kitchen where all her potted plants were, silverware sticking out of the dirt of the plants. So a true Orthodox woman to the end. very interesting. All right, well, let's get back on track here. Enough about that. And people, by the way, this is called the talk show. That doesn't mean that Gadi and Rabbi and Reese get to talk all the time. There's this thing called a phone number. We were just talking about telephones. So pick it up and push the following buttons, 347-857-1380. It's really sad that we don't get any phone calls.
This is like an audience participation thing?
It's supposed to be.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I'm getting to the point where I miss Saba calling in, bitching at me about Islam. It's really sad if I've gotten to the point that I miss Saba. And Reese's going, no, Saba, please.
You should do what we did on our study show. I told people if they weren't going to call in and answer the questions, then basically I was going to sit here and I was going to sing Conway Twitty. And I did it.
Oh, no. Don't. People, please start calling 347-857-1380. Do not make the rabbi become a rabbi Twitty, okay? Anyway, I want to, well, you know what? We've got to do the news because it's almost 9, and we have to do the news before 9 o'clock. So let's hit the news real quick.
It's now time for the national and international news here on America Off Star with Gadi Amos.
Risha and I had talked about redoing that because she sounds so quiet in the music, but we forgot all about it. Anyway, our lead story tonight is thanks to Rabbi Ariel Nachman. Because, as you know, Rabbi, you posted it on my Facebook page. Something new is going to happen in Dearborn, Michigan this year. So, after 4 years of increasing tensions between some Christian missionaries and local Muslims, the annual Arab International Festival in Dearborn is being moved from a street that has open access to a public park that could resist admission to paid attendees. So they're planning on moving it from an open street that had open access to a park where they can restrict admission. Dearborn Mayor Jack O'Reilly said on Friday that the city plans to shift the festival, the biggest annual outdoor gathering of Arab Americans in the United States, from Warren Avenue to Ford Woods Park near the corner of Ford and Greenfield Roads. One of the reasons for the move is the liability concerns. The city has been hit with lawsuits from Christian missionaries alleging their free speech rights were curtailed at the festival. Alleging?
And lost. And lost their cases.
Yes, that's why I said alleging.
Yeah.
Considering everything we've been through and what has happened in the past, said O'Reilly, the city wanted a place where you can have a controlled site, otherwise known as Sharia. The 18-year-old festival held in June by the American Arab Chamber of Commerce promotes Arab American culture and business along Warren Avenue. Faye Badoun, executive director of the chamber, said Friday that the group is working with the city on negotiating a price to rent out the park for the 3-day festival planned this year from June 15th through the 17th. There could be an admission fee to enter the park for the festival, which includes carnival games, amusement park rides, and numerous vendor booths on Arab American culture. The festival has long had Christian missionaries in attendance, and there weren't any tensions in the past. However, that all changed in 2009. And I love the way they worded this, after an aggressive new group of missionaries started to arrive. Oh, they were so aggressive. We're not talking about Reuben Israel just yet. We're talking about Dave Woods, who's been a guest on this show many times. And trust me, the man is far from aggressive. And most of his followers are Muslims who converted to Christianity, but that's a whole other story. Anyway, however, that all changed in 2009 after an aggressive new group of missionaries started to arrive. That year, some yelled at festival goers, quote, that they were going to hell because they were Muslim, according to a Dearborn police report. Some also brought video cameras and recorded their encounters, which they then posted online, sparking complaints about Dearborn's Muslim population. The tensions resulted in some Christian missionaries being escorted out. The next year, a group of them were arrested. They were later acquitted after a trial and have filed a lawsuit against the city. Other Christians have also filed a lawsuit saying that their First Amendment rights were restricted. Some have said that treatment at the festival proves that Dearborn is under Sharia or Islamic law, a claim that the mayor has repeatedly dismissed as ludicrous. The mayor's Dearborn Muslims told Christians, go home, Sharia is coming. The Wayne County Sheriff's Office has handled security at the event for the past 2 years.
Shouldn't that be mishandled?
Yes, it should be. Dearborn Police Department is expected to mishandle it this year, O'Reilly said. The tensions escalated last year after a group called the Bible Believers brought a pig's head mounted on a pole along with signs that denigrated Islam and its prophet Muhammad in explicit terms, and observant Muslims consider pigs to be dirty. Now, let me explain here, folks. That would be Reuben Israel, and yes, he was a guest on the show. Yes, I had an exclusive interview with him where we talked about the fact that he was there was a murder attempt on him and eight of his followers while they were there. In response, some children got upset, and a few hurled objects, including water bottles, at them. Some children, go and watch the videos. They're in my article about it. O'Reilly said free speech must be respected, but he's concerned that some groups were trying to provoke young children at the festival with outrageous words and signs. He said, and I quote, "We're not going to tolerate people insulting children, making gross statements, antagonizing children. We're going to make sure kids behave, but we're also going to make sure that the adults behave. Everybody's got to behave. In the past, no one had any problems," said O'Reilly. "But over the past few years, it became a target for people who have a different agenda. They weren't here in the spirit of the festival." Oh, my gosh. Imad Hamad, regional director of the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee and a Dearborn resident, said he supports the move, noting that the Warren Avenue location sometimes got congested. Majid Mughani, a Dearborn attorney and activist, said he also supports the move, but he said that festival goers could continue to face hostile speech from some of the missionaries. He said, and I quote, "They can still stand on the city sidewalks or in the front entrance." And by the way, Mughani disagreed with the police arrests of the missionaries back in 2010. And he said, "You can't violate someone's free speech." Well, it's funny, Rabbi, that he said you can still stand on the city sidewalks, because that's exactly where Reuben and his friends were standing when a guy almost ran him down with an SUV, literally driving over the curb, up onto a hill in front of a mosque and down the opposite side at full speed, aiming directly for them, trying to kill them. And yes, well, even if we never heard about it, he was brought up on 9 counts of attempted murder.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but the other missionaries that were there were also on the sidewalk. Some of them were arrested and so on and so forth, right?
Yeah, the original arrests came before Reuben was there last year, came back in what they referred to in that article in 2009, when David Woods and his Act 17 group was there, and we had them, all of them on the show. There were 4 of them that were arrested and later acquitted of the charges, and they've been on the show before as guests. 3 of the 4 of them are actually Muslim converts to Christianity who were not causing any problems. There was video to prove it. They were walking around. They were not handing anything out. They were not bothering anybody. They did have video cameras for their own safety, and it's a good thing they did. And they were wearing shirts about Jesus. Their T-shirts had different sayings on it about Jesus. And when the Muslims approached them, asking them about their shirts, they asked them, "Well, do you want to discuss it?" And then they would start to discuss it as a Muslim who had left the faith and found Christianity. And then they were arrested and escorted off the property, put in jail, and they were told it was because they were blocking the road, even though it was a third thoroughfare, whatever you call it, a fairway through the middle of this park. So it was pretty interesting, and you can go to act17.com and see all the videos on that as well as on my website. Anyway, so this year, Rabbi, it looks like we're not going to be going to Dearborn.
Well, you know, that brings up something that we discussed way back when we were talking about possibly getting a booth at the Muslim fair.
And on
that, the reason for that is because the Muslim society there in Dearborn controls all of the booths. You have to actually know somebody there to be able to actually get an application. You can't come from the outside and say, well, you know, I want to be a vendor at the fair. Just like if you went to any other fair website, they would have a place where you click on and you say, I want to be a vendor and this is what I do and this is what it's going to cost and anything. You can't do that at this fair. They have to approve you. They have to allow you to be there.
And let me explain real quick. I want to throw this out there, you know, just so people understand, there's nothing illegal about that. It's their fair. They can decide who they do and don't want. But when they're calling it a Arab American or an American Arab festival, you know, if the word American is in there, if they want to call it an Arab festival and only have Arab booths, you know what? I don't care. I don't have issue with that. But if you're going to say, hey, we're American Arabs, and we're going to have booths about the American Arab culture, which is what it said in the article, quoting the mayor, then don't say, well, you can come because you're an Arab and your stuff has to do with Muslims and Islam versus anyone else that wants a booth. Well, that's not, you know, that's just not Muslim. Well, no, what happened to America? You know, if you want to assimilate, if you want to be part of this culture, have some booths that have to do with the American culture. But anyway, real quick, Rabbi,
just one more thing.
Yeah, go ahead.
The question that comes to my mind is this: if this is an Arab American festival, how many Coptic Christian booths do we see there?
Zero. Yeah. Let me, for that matter, how many Yemenite booths? That would be Arab Jews, people. Yeah, how many of those Mizrahi booths are there?
Yeah. And
we've got two different callers waiting, so we're going to grab them in order here. And Jenny has been on hold the longest, and then we're going to have Wild Bill come on. Jenny, how you doing?
Good.
Thank you for calling in, dear. Did you have a comment or a question about Dearborn?
Well, I got a comment, but it's in the form of a question. They're concerned about children, but are these the same people who, for no apparent reason, will kill a whole family? And they're concerned about children?
Yeah, well, that's the same people that like to strap bombs onto their own children. You know, good point.
Well, if you go to the video, though, and you see what was actually going on with Reuben Israel, and just so everybody is clear, I don't agree with his tactics, but regardless, if you go and you see what happened, these kids that they were so concerned about were running back to the adults. The adults were telling them what to do, and they were running back and grabbing milk crates, chairs, concrete blocks, and all of that stuff.
Yeah, it wasn't just empty water bottles. It wasn't plastic bottles. And, Rabbi, you bring up a point. You know, we talked about this, and honestly, I don't remember if it was on my show, Radio Jihad, on Monday night with Alan and Vito or both, but I spoke specifically about my own experience in having watched how the Arabs and the Muslims in Israel use their children as that front line, and that is exactly the same tactic that we saw in Dearborn, and that's what the rabbi is referring to. They show in these videos where you can see the little kids getting instructions from the adults, then going and carrying out those instructions, and when they're done, running back to the adults to get more instruction. And they do that for a reason. Number one, they know the kids will not face the same harsh terms if arrested, which probably won't happen in Dearborn, but nonetheless, as an adult who's over 18. And they're not going to be looked upon, oh, it's just kids, you know, it's not the adults that were doing it. So it's the same tactic that we saw in the West Bank and in Gaza when I lived in Israel. They're following that to a T. Jenny, you're
absolutely
right.
Plus it makes better video coverage for the news.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Let me bring up.
But I wonder if everybody understands why they put their children in the front lines.
Children that get hurt make good headlines.
Well, it's not just that. If you have a child that dies in jihad, becomes a martyr, the whole family gets a pass.
Yes. Yes. And that was Wild Bill, by the way. Welcome, Wild Bill.
Hey, guys. Good show. I'm glad to see you covering that Dearborn issue. You guys are doing a really good job. I'm enjoying this show a lot.
It's been a while since you've been on, Bill. How's things going?
Things are going pretty good. I'm still rabble-rousing all across America, going to take on the liberal left. Got my new T-Teams USA starting up. And Dearborn would have been a good place to, you know, make a stand for American freedom, but I guess that's out this year.
Well,
but
speaking of the liberals, I got to interrupt, Bill, because I got a bone to pick with you. I saw a video a couple of days ago, and I just got to tell you, you've been hanging out with those liberals too long. That hat and those John Lennon glasses has just got to go.
Well, they went. I threw the glasses off the balcony while I was making the video. I couldn't stand it either.
I took a look at the picture. It scared the hell out of me.
It scared me too. It really did. That I don't know where you got that hat, but you need to burn it. Just, you know, stick some book inside the hat before you set it on fire, and you know, insert your favorite book here. But that was a frightening, and the way you did that on the camera, I honest to God, Bill, I was sitting here at my computer and I had tears streaming down my face because I know you so much better than that, and it had to hurt. It had to physically hurt you to make that video.
Oh well. One of my favorite things to do is to make people spit coffee on their computer screens, and I actually got an email from somebody saying that I did that with that video. So
it
was worth it. I'm happy.
Well, I'm glad I didn't have anything to drink while doing it, but it was an interesting video. And I don't want to stay on the Dearborn topic too long because there's so many other things, and it's already after 9. But I want to. This is an interesting report that the United States. Report came out of the worst violators of religious freedom. Oh, everybody, you're going to love this. An arm of the U.S. government named 15 nations as the, quote, worst violators of religious freedom. The Commission on International Religious Freedom, otherwise known as the USCIRF, an independent advisory body created by the International Religious Freedom Act, to monitor religious freedom abuses internationally, released its 2013 report today, which identifies governments that are the most egregious violators. Okay, everybody, sit down because you're going to be in for a shock when you hear the names of these 15 countries. The 15 countries are, drum roll please, wait a minute, Burma, China, Eritrea, Iran, North Korea, Saudi Arabia, Sudan, Uzbekistan, Egypt, Iraq, Nigeria, Pakistan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Vietnam, all of which severely restrict independent religious activity and harass individuals and groups for religious activity or beliefs. These nations are classified as Tier 1 countries of particular concern in the report. Despite its recent opening and political reforms, changes in Burma have yet to significantly improve the situation for freedom of religion and belief. The report states that most violations occurred against the minority Christian and Muslim adherents. Interesting that the Muslims are on the receiving end of it for a change in Burma. China, their government, is also cited for its ongoing severe abuses against citizens' freedom of thought. Now, the report said, and I love this, that Egypt's transitional and newly elected governments have made progress towards religious freedom. Nonetheless, it made the list. But it further highlighted the attacks, are you ready for this, that Coptic Christians have sustained in the period after the Arab Spring that brought down the Mubarak regime. And I'll quote the report here. In many cases, the government failed or was slow to protect religious minorities from violence, end quote. The former states of Tajikistan and Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan were included for pursuing state control over religion. Oh my God, Iraq was cited for, among other things, tolerating violent, religiously motivated attacks, and Iran for prolonged detention, torture, and even executions based primarily or entirely on the religion of the accused. Saudi Arabia continues to suppress religious practices outside the officially sanctioned Wahhabi interpretation of Islam, interferes with the faith of guest workers, and prosecutes individuals for apostasy, blasphemy, and sorcery, according to the report. Pakistan has a strict blasphemy law and failure to prosecute acts of religious violence, the report said. The situation in Sudan has deteriorated since South Sudan gained its independence. Criminalization of apostasy and the government's strict interpretation of Sharia on both Muslims and non-Muslims and its attacks against Christians were cited in the report for their decline. The report also identified Nigeria for continuing religious violence between the Muslims and the Christians, compounded by the government's toleration of the sectarian attacks. North Korea's regime was also included for its ongoing harassment and torture of citizens based on religious beliefs. The second tier, get ready for this, guys, the second tier of list of countries includes Afghanistan, Azerbaijan, Cuba, India, Indonesia, Kazakhstan, Laos, and Russia, where abuses of religious freedom are tolerated by the government and meet the threshold by the U.S. Department of State, but don't yet meet all of the standards for, quote, systematic, ongoing, egregious measurements. Other countries that are being monitored include Bahrain, Bangladesh, Ethiopia, Turkey, Venezuela, and Western Europe. Well, what a shocker! How many of those countries are Islamic countries? And those that aren't, it's the Muslims that are creating the problem.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, was Burma on that list?
Burma was on tier one, yes.
Okay, now Burma, we have to understand that Buddhists have been attacking the Muslims over the last year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Seriously, how bad does it have to be for you to piss off a Buddhist so much that he will actually come after you? Seriously.
We're talking about Buddhists here. Oh, my gosh.
I mean, you got to be really bad to get them people ticked off.
Yeah, we don't see Buddhists strapping bombs to themselves. We've talked about this on the show before. Oh, my gosh, you are not kidding. How bad do you have to be to get a Buddhist angry? That's a good question, to get him angry enough to do violence.
Well, I have a question for you guys.
Yes, sir.
There was a report a while back that there were 35 million Muslims in northern China, and the Chinese government was doing their crackdown on them. And I have been waiting to hear the score on that. I can't think of two groups that deserve each other more, the Muslims and the Chinese communists. And I'm hoping they'll come out with a reality TV show or something, because that's something that I would really want to see. Have you heard anything on that?
I can answer your question about the score. It's about 35 million China to zero Muslims. China won't put up with it, and the reason we won't hear about it, as we all know, is because of the way they are with their, you know, their media. They're still a communist country, and if they don't want it on the air, it's not going to come out. But yeah, I've talked about it on this show before. You know, it is not uncommon when I've even said, and people have questioned it, I don't care if you're a Muslim in the Middle East or in China, there's a lot of Muslims in China. They are all over the world. And yeah, China's not going to stand for that. So I don't know, honestly, what's happened to them. I couldn't even tell you if those 35 million Muslims are even still alive, Bill. I have no idea.
Yeah, just an interesting mental picture there. I was wondering what happens when China stomps on 35 million Muslims. What are the other Muslims of the world going to do?
Well, see, that's how smart China is when you think about it. They're not going to get that or let that get out to the media of the world, because they know that there would be repercussions in their own country from it. They're not stupid, unlike other countries that we know. Oh, man. Now, the U.S. is rethinking resistance to arming the Syrian opposition. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel said today that the Obama administration is rethinking its opposition to arming the Syrian rebels as officials weigh a range of options in the wake of findings that chemical weapons were likely used in the country's civil war. Quote, arming the rebels, that's an option, Hagel said at the press conference today in the Pentagon. Asked directly if the administration was reconsidering its opposition to that option, Hagel said yes. The comment cracks open the door, if only a little, to the United States getting more involved in the bloody Syrian war. President Obama, speaking separately at a press conference in the middle of a trip of Mexico, said today that Hagel's remarks were, quote, what I've been saying for months now. Obama said the U.S. still needs to look before we leap and make sure that any steps the country takes to serve the advance, pardon me, that the country takes to takes serve to advance the cause of regime change. The administration last week revealed that U.S. intelligence found evidence that the regime had used chemical weapons, specifically sarin gas, on a, quote, small scale in Syria. The White House, however, stressed that investigators would need to find out more about how that nerve gas was released before acting on that intelligence. Obama has long called the use of chemical weapons in Syria, quote, a red line that would prompt the U.S. action if crossed. Hagel said today that the U.S. must rethink all their options, though it doesn't mean you do or you will use those options.
In other words, what they've decided is that maybe they'll write a second sternly worded letter.
Mm.
Yes.
They're
exactly.
Definitely going to fire off another letter, yeah. These are options that must be considered with partners with the international community, Hagel said. At the same news conference, British Defense Secretary Philip Hammond said that his government has not yet provided arms to the Syrian rebels, but had not ruled it out. He also said it appears the regime is largely in control of its chemical weapons sites. The administration could be faced with several options if it chooses to get more involved in the Syrian conflict. Some have called for the establishment of a no-fly zone and even limited airstrikes, but arming the opposition could represent a middle ground. Some lawmakers have been urging the Obama administration for months to take that step. Obama, in a press conference on Tuesday, warned against, and I quote, rushing to judgment without hard, effective evidence. He said it's important to move forward in a prudent way. And only because of the lack of time, I want to, because I've got some international news from Israel, but I want to play a couple of audio clips. And the first one is Obama at that press conference, which was April 30th, just a couple days ago on Tuesday, and he was asked about Benghazi. And this is real interesting because if anybody's been paying attention to Fox News, because they broke this story, they have four people that were in Benghazi that want to come forward and tell their story, but they're being threatened by the administration. Blatantly, we're told your career will be over and you could face up to 20 years in jail. So this is what these people are being told, and they've come forward in shadow with changed voice to be interviewed on Fox News. Obama was asked about it at a press conference. I want to play that clip.
And on the Benghazi question, I know pieces of this story have been litigated, and you've been asked about it. But there are people in your own State Department saying they've been blocked from coming forward, that they survived the terror attack, and they want to tell their story. Will you help them come forward and just say it once and for all?
Ed, I'm not familiar with this notion that anybody's been blocked from testifying. So what I'll do is I will find out what exactly you're referring to. What I've been very clear about from the start is that our job with respect to Benghazi has been to find out exactly what happened, to make sure that U.S. embassies, not just in the Middle East but around the world, are safe and secure, and to bring those who carried it out to justice. But I'll find out what exactly you're referring to.
They hired an attorney because they're saying that they've been blocked from coming forward.
I'm not familiar with it.
I'm not familiar with it. Now, how is the president of these United States not familiar with it? I've got
an answer for that.
Yeah, it's called bullshit.
No. He's only attended 49% of the national security briefings. He's got plausible deniability.
Yeah, he's got plausible deniability, except Fox is already reporting proof that he was well aware of it, but that's beside the point. Aware
yeah,
of
that's
it,
beside the
people
point.
Have been blocked. But here's another clip, okay? And this is from yesterday. So it was a day after Obama was asked about this. It was a day after Obama said, you just heard him, I'll look into it. I'm not familiar with it, but I'll look into it. Here's how Jay Carney, yesterday, at a press conference, the daily White House press briefing, here's how he answered the question about Obama looking into it. This is very interesting. Let me play this.
Last thing on Benghazi, since the president spoke yesterday briefly about that, the Defense Department and the State Department both have written letters, as I understand it, to Republican Darrell Issa saying that they're not aware of anyone coming to them asking for security clearances for their counsel or anything to come forward. Mm-hmm. First, is that your understanding? And second, if someone were to come forward, if they just haven't technically told their superior or something, if they were to come forward, is the White House willing to let them testify?
Well, again, I mean, that's a hypothetical, but let's be clear. Benghazi happened a long time ago. We are unaware of any agency blocking an employee who would like to appear before Congress to provide information related to Benghazi.
Benghazi happened a long time ago? Are you freaking kidding me? What are we talking about, ancient history here? That's their answer now. Well, let's just get this straight. Benghazi happened a long time ago. Oh, okay, so we can just forget it. It was so long ago. I'm sure those families have forgotten about the people that were killed, and they're not grieving for their loved ones. It was so long ago. Do you believe this? Either of you guys, chime in. It was a long time ago.
Yeah, well, yeah. In the grand scheme of this administration, that's a long time. But what difference does it make?
What difference does any of this make, whether it was some guys out for a walk who decided to kill some Americans or not? Thank you, Mrs. Clinton. Yeah, a long time ago. It happened a long time. I can't believe that Jay Carney said that, swept it under the proverbial prayer rug, and went on with his press conference. He never answered the question. It happened, let's just be clear, and that's another thing. Where did he get that line from? Who is it that we always hear saying, let's just be clear? Because that's what he said. I'll play it again. He said, let's just be clear. Benghazi happened a long time ago. No, it didn't, you ass. It was 7 months ago. I don't know what a long time is in your world, but 7 months is not a long time ago. Oh, my God. Are we going to be saying that 7 months after Boston? Did we say that 7 months after 9/11? It was a long time ago. Give me a frickin' break. Ugh. Sorry.
Hey, no problem. Well, you know, they've really pissed off the Navy SEALs with this Benghazi thing because two of their own members were killed. And I recently met with some of the special forces operators of the military, retired officers, high-ranking officers, and these guys are tracking down and finding the witnesses that the Obama administration has been trying to hide. They are the ones that have been convincing these guys to come forward and speak, and there's a deal in the works to give these witnesses protection so that the Obama administration cannot come against them, and they expect these guys to be able to start telling their story as early as next week.
You know, it's amazing because, and I did see your video about that where you mentioned that, Bill. It's amazing that, first of all, that we're even discussing the fact that military people, American heroes, have to worry about being protected from the government to come
yes.
out with the truth. That in itself is just sends a chill up my spine. But I wouldn't put it past this current administration that these guys need, and gals, need protection. But, you know, I heard somebody say the other day or today, Nixon, with Watergate, Nixon lied, but nobody died. Benghazi was a long time ago. You know, what we need to stop. We've been harping on this since it happened. We broke the story here on this show with Steve from California, Hog Rider, as you guys know him on the show. Steve called in one night to talk about something completely different and mentioned that a connection, one of his sources, had told him that there were 30 people, or upwards of 30 people, staying at Walter Reed Medical Center who were being watched by, and get this, the Secret Service. The entire floor was shut off, and they were not allowed to speak to the press. They were all survivors of Benghazi. And we talked about it on this show because that same day, one of my sources told me the same thing. He and I spoke off the air thinking it was the same person, and we had two different sources. So we both heard it from two different credible, reliable sources. This was a good 2 months ago.
or maybe even more, I don't even remember, it might be 3 months ago, that I talked about on this very show with Steve from California that there were survivors, possibly as many as 30, that were being hidden at Walter Reed Medical Center, guarded by the Secret Service, not being allowed to come forward and speak out. And now we have these guys that are coming forward, and they have to shadow themselves on TV. They have to alter their voices because they're being told, not only will your career be over, but you are liable to face up to 20 years in prison if you tell this story. What in the hell is so bad that it's national security, because that's what they would punish them on. That's the only way to put somebody in jail that's a government employee that went through something like that for 20 years. The only way to do it is by utilizing the legality that they are divulging national security secrets. There is no secrets about Benghazi other than what happened. It wasn't something... I mean, it's driving me crazy that this is, and people are forgetting about it.
We have whistleblower laws already in place, but this administration has been stepping all over them, and this is in this case in particular, they are telling these people that they have to come forward and acknowledge who they are first before they will actually allow their lawyers to get clearance to represent them, but it's in direct violation of the whistleblower laws.
And the problem that the special forces operators have been told is that after Benghazi, all of these people were forced to sign non-disclosure agreements by the government. And I made the point during our meetings that if these non-disclosure agreements were signed under duress, they hold no water. So I think that's going to be the opening that they need to get this story out.
Well, anybody who's in special ops, Bill, as you well know, regardless of anything they had to sign recently, when they go into that particular portion of the military, when they get that kind of clearance, they have to sign non-disclosure forms to begin with.
None of these witnesses are special ops.
Right, and a lot of them may have just been diplomatic people that were over there, and you've got a situation, though, where 7 months ago, four Americans were killed. Now, granted, it was not an embassy. Granted, it was not a consulate. However, it was being utilized, call it a safe house, call it a CIA house, call it whatever you want. I forget the term Claire Lopez used that coined the phrase. But it was a locale that was owned or at least being rented by the U.S. government for U.S. purposes in Benghazi, and our ambassador to Libya was there, and he was murdered. It was American soil. And now you've got 7 months later the president saying, I'm not aware of any of these witnesses wanting to come forward or being blocked. And the very next day after he says he's going to look into it, the next question, the follow-up by the same reporter to Jay Carney, the answer is, let's be clear, it happened a long time ago. On to the next question. This is ridiculous that the American public is sitting by and letting this administration do this to us time after time after time. This is not the only thing Obama has done.
Let me ask another question. What law allows the president to hide actions from Congress?
None.
And why isn't Congress raising hell about this?
This is what you and I talked about a week or two ago, Rabbi. Where in the hell are these so-called conservative Republicans that are up in the House and the Senate? And why are, the only one I'm hearing from is Michelle Bachmann and a former congressman by the name of Alan West.
Right.
That's it. I mean,
they're probably under the boot heels of John Boehner.
I'm sorry, we were talking over top of each other. Say again, Bill.
They're probably under the boot heels of John Boehner, Obama's lapdog. Obama has ordered Boehner to keep his people quiet, and Boehner's putting pressure on him.
But what has he got on them? That's what I don't understand. What is so stinking?
I'll tell you what they have. These guys are terrified of the mainstream media. The mainstream media is so powerful nowadays that they make or break careers. These guys know that if they cross Obama or Hillary, the mainstream media will sink their fangs into them, and their career may very well be over. So these guys are more worried about their own skins than they are about getting to the truth or justice.
You know, you talk about the mainstream media, and that is a segue to the next thing on the agenda, which I wanted to cover tonight, which is the handling of these, you know, I don't even get to hear the word terrorist enough, because when they're talking about these poor boys, they're only 19-year-old kids. If I hear the term kid one more time, I'm going to end up having to buy a new television. They're not kids, okay? If you're 18, 17 with parental consent, and you want to join the U.S. military, and you go and fight for this country, you're a man. And if you go and you decide to put a bomb in a knapsack and place it at the feet of people that are just civilians out for the day anywhere in this country, and you're 19 years old, you're a man. These are not poor little kids. I'm sick of this crap. I don't care whether he was 6 years old or 60 years old. It's the same thing. And I'm sick of the, what's the motive? They didn't assimilate. They didn't have any friends. You know, for a couple of guys that didn't have any friends, I'm seeing an awful lot of interviews with people that are referring to themselves as friends.
Well, they keep showing that picture of I won't even say his name, but the one that's still alive. They keep showing that picture of him that's, what, 3-4 years old?
Jahar. They keep showing the picture of him from when he was a child. CNN, I talked about that last week. CNN keeps utilizing that picture instead of a current photograph, which we know they have.
That's the Trayvon Martin tactic.
Hoodies
and hijabs.
Exactly. Everybody, hoodies and hijabs. You know, it's ridiculous. And now you've got these other kids. I love this. These other kids, all 19-year-old men who are students in this country with the let's pronounce the name game. And let me go back to the top of my notes here with Diaz Kabyobeyev, Azmat Kazakov, and Robel Filipos. You've got these three young men who their claim to what actually happened is so ludicrous. Yeah, we recognize that they were probably the terrorists, and we even sent a text with LOL, laugh out loud, you look a lot like him. But we went into the apartment and we took a knapsack that we found and we had the sense to put Vaseline. Now, let's talk about the Vaseline for a second. Rabbi, were you aware of the fact that Vaseline is used in making a homemade bomb?
No, I was not aware of that.
Okay, now, I'd hate to admit this, and I'll probably be on God knows how many watch lists for saying it. I was aware of that. I don't know too many people who are. I'm aware of other home remedies or objects that can be utilized. And off air, I may even tell the rabbi about it, because I guarantee you he's got some in his house. There's a lot of things that are utilized in making a homemade bomb. Why did these three individuals, these three Utes, to quote Joe Pesci, decide to take the Vaseline along with the fireworks, which, by the way, all the powder had been emptied out of them, and put it in a knapsack, which, by the way, was the exact identical knapsack they saw on TV in the video, and throw it away, and then claim, we didn't know that they were really the bombers. We didn't know that we were doing anything wrong. And what about the laptop? Oh, yes, the laptop. Well, guess what's going to come off of that sucker? Because this was not homegrown terrorism. Homegrown terrorists don't know how to make this type of mechanism. And I'm going to explain why. Yes, I did on this very show talk about the fact that you could go to the Inspire magazine on the Al-Qaeda website in English, where they wrote an article last year called How to make a bomb in your mom's kitchen. However, even though it talked about the pressure cooker, and even though it talked about gluing nails to the inside of the pressure cooker, and even though it talked about what types of gunpowder or accelerant you could use, it didn't mention Vaseline. And on top of that, nowhere in that article did it talk about using a remote control device. That's the kicker. That's how we know he was trained in Dagestan when he went there for 6 months. Which I might add, he was receiving asylum in this country. How do you get asylum in the United States? You need to be in fear for your life. You have to prove to the U.S. government that if you go back to your country of origin, you are going to die. So he was so in fear for his life that he went there on vacation for 6 months, and he used our welfare dollars to do it.
Yeah, you're talking about key pieces of information being missing from that article. You know, it's the MacGyver thing.
Yes.
You know, when the MacGyver thing was on there, they always left out certain key pieces of whatever he was doing so that people wouldn't replicate it.
You know, and Jenny, I know you're on hold, sweetie, and I apologize. It's 9:37, and I do want to take one more quick break because we've only done one break tonight, and I need to get some more tea because my throat's on fire. So, anyway, where is Reese? My board has changed. There she is, Reese.
Oh my God!
If Jenny doesn't mind waiting, I know she wants to comment and join in the conversation about these. Five individuals and the what is their name? Major feedback off of you, Reese. What do you have lined up next song?
Oh, you know what? Hang on just a sec. There we go. Because my board got messed up today, I'm having to refind everything. How about we do a little bit of Matt Fitzgibbons? They can't take that away from you, and you can find him over at patriotmusic.com.
No. visitors to George's Gin Joint include Bear Grylls, the survivalist, Godfather Don Corleone, former Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, Secretary of the Department of Bitch-Slapping Hilda, Darth Vader, even President Richard Nixon popped in. So come visit the hottest place for happy hour every Friday at 5 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Central, and show the world that you have an American view.
Iraq and Afghanistan. Our brave warriors are coming home. Wounded. Some with wounds you can see. Some with wounds you can't see. The Wounded Warrior Project was created to support our men and women coming off the battlefield. Please help carry these warriors the rest of the way. Get involved at WoundedWarriorProject.org.
Hey everybody, this is Dave Bray of Madison Rising, and you're listening to America at Bar with Scott H.
Thanks, everybody, for staying through the break. And with us tonight, we've got Rabbi Ariel Nachman, as usual. While Bill dropped out, and I'm not sure whether he had to go, I wasn't watching the chat room, or whether he was having phone issues. And we've also got Jenny on the line, who wanted to join in on the conversation about the terrorists in Boston. And I just want to tell everybody, and I think Jenny may have been one... Jenny, were you one of the people that Facebook or emailed me that I had predicted what happened in Boston like just a couple weeks before it happened?
Yes, you. From what I saw, you predicted it. What the time I heard you, it was like less than a week.
Yeah, and I want to let everybody know it wasn't a prediction like I knew when something was going to happen. What I was talking about was that we were going to start seeing bombs go off in this country. And I've said time and time again, you know, planes are probably not going to be used again until we become really lax on that possibly happening. But bombs, what we saw in Boston, folks, I don't want to scare you, but you need to know the truth. This is the beginning. We're going to see more of this. And we need to understand that now more than ever, how vigilant each and every individual in this country has to be. And for God's sakes, if it looks out of place to you, if you see something, say something. But anyway, Jenny, welcome back to the show. And what did you want to say?
Well, you know, I watch crime investigation stuff on Well, it's not on cable. It's on Netflix. So I
okay.
watch some British stuff. So I did know that you could use Vaseline.
Somebody who pays attention.
You know, but the thing of it is, you know, you get it a little bit from British television because they don't disclose everything either. You get a little bit of ingredients. Do I know how to make one? No, but I know that if you got Vaseline in your house, you know, it's flammable.
Well, there's
even
a reason.
It tells you on the package
that
it's flammable.
There's a reason, folks, that if you read what it's called, it's petroleum jelly. Oh, my gosh. There's a lot of things that can be used to make an explosive. Vaseline is just one of many ingredients. There's a multitude of ingredients. They have to be put together in the proper order. They have to be put together the right amount. And there's no guarantee that it ain't going to blow up in your face. And that's another way we know, with the amount of bombs that these two made, there had to have been training. There's just no way in hell this guy read this online and did this in his kitchen. Not with what he had. He had training. It was, well, that's a whole other show. But anyway, I'm a little bit, a lot perturbed. as to what's going on with these new three individuals, you know, the American teen and the pair of Kazakhstan students that were arrested. And you know, granted, they're facing, quote, hard time, and they're being put under, quote, intense pressure to tell everything they know. But the way it's being treated in the media is going to create a larger, more possibility situation, a more probable situation that we're going to see more and more of this throughout the country. This is what's happening because they're not stupid. You know, I've said it before. Terrorists are a lot of things. Stupid isn't one of them. And they see how the American public reacts to this stuff, and they see where the holes in our security are, and they're going to use it to their advantage. And when they see the mainstream media being afraid to use the word Islam, jihadist, Muslim, terrorist, even radical, which I don't like that term, when they see the American public hearing that coming out of the mainstream media, it gives them more of an incentive because they know that if I get caught, the media and the public will be on my side. Oh, what was the motive of these two? I'll tell you what the motive was. It was the Quran. They're Islamic. End of story. You don't need to look any further. Can anybody tell me what the motive of that so-called workplace violence was? How come I haven't heard from anybody? They're so quick to change the terminology. They're calling it workplace violence. Can somebody, Rabbi, can you tell me what was so horrible with Nadal Hassan's work that he decided to go out and be postal and kill his fellow employees? What happened to him at his job? Has anybody ever said what was so bad with this man's job that he decided to create a workplace violence?
There were so many signals that this guy was going in this direction for so long before this. When he took his military business card and on it he put AOA.
SOA.
Pardon? Oh, yeah, SOA. Excuse me. When he put SOA on there, it should have been a big red flag to them, and they should have, you know, if nothing else, should have marshaled him out.
That in itself, you know, people see SOA on a business card. For those that found or received his business card that didn't know what SOA meant, he was out there telling people what it meant. It stands for Soldier of Allah, S-O-A. It was right on his business card, as the rabbi said. There were so many signs. And let me tell you, when it comes to signs, I don't care what you're hearing in the news. Our national security sucks when it came to what happened in Boston. Whether it was the FBI, whether it was the CIA, because they also were notified about this pair from Russia, and we're finding out now Saudi Arabia, they dropped the ball. It's 9/11 all over again. This is ridiculous. The fact that they got as far as they did and managed to set off these explosives, there were so many times that they should have been stopped. They were being investigated while they were building these bombs, but the FBI couldn't find anything wrong?
Well, and then we're finding out, too, that you know, where Hillary was able to deflect a lot of direct blame by saying, well, we didn't get the emails and so on and so forth, you know, in direct opposition to the flash message and all that stuff. We're finding out now from Russia that Russia called. They didn't just send an email.
Exactly.
They called.
Exactly. And Saudi Arabia evidently also sent us a notification on these same individuals. How is it that the Saudi authorities, which is by no stretch of the imagination non-Islamic, how is it that the Saudi authorities were giving the United States a heads up on these two, but we couldn't find anything when they were living right here? Let's start with the asylum fact. If they were looking into him, why didn't they question the fact that he went back to Russia for 6 months? Why didn't they question the fact that he went from his home in Chechnya and spent 6 months in Dagestan? Hello, you don't have to be a freaking counter-terror expert or a rocket scientist. If it ends with the word Stan, you got a problem. Whether it's Dagestan, Kazakhstan, Afghanistan, you know, Turkmenistan, I don't care. Pick your Stan. There were so many things that were going on. The text that Russia notified the United States about was this man's mother and he, and I'm talking about the brother Tamerlan that was killed, he in a text, his mother and he went back and forth discussing jihad. Yeah, there's a real sweet lady. Oh, my boys wouldn't do that. This woman had the audacity in an interview to claim that we in America actually painted, get this, we painted the sidewalks with red paint to make it look like blood, and the whole thing was a frame-up.
Right.
Yeah, red paint. But my boys would never do this. One of them's named after the Chechen rebel, and the other one's named after a jihadist. But my boys, oh, they were friends. They were good boys. They would never do this. Doesn't matter that we were texting back and forth about jihad.
Well, plus she was texting to other relatives or other friends of hers, bragging about the fact that they were, you know, they were jihadists.
Ann Vanderleest in the chat room, I refuse to answer your question unless you call in and ask it. No, I'm kidding. Ann in the chat room is asking, where's the first suspect, the Saudi boy? You know what? At this point, I'm not even sure if he's even still in this country, Ann. I would suggest, because the man on top of it has been Glenn Beck, I would suggest going to the Blaze and following up on that. With everything else going on, I kind of sort of have, I won't say I've forgotten about him, but I've neglected him. There are definite ties to that. Other things have come out. They found his name on a group list of a visit to the White House from a couple of years ago. So it's really interesting what's happening with this kid. There's an awful lot of coincidences out there. And as I've said it before, to quote Gibbs from NCIS, I don't believe in coincidences.
Now, you said something about these three guys that are now being looked at, about them looking at long prison sentences?
The Utes.
Yeah, the Utes. The Utes. Did you say
that would
Utes?
Be Diaz, Kabyarebev, Azmat Tazakov, and Robel Filipos.
Okay. Israel News, Arutsheva, is reporting that these guys are looking at a maximum sentence of 5 years. Filipos is looking at a maximum sentence of 8 years.
Okay, that's
and that
correct.
Comes along with a $250,000 fine. Right. That doesn't sound like it's that long to me.
Yeah. It's because
as you know, in the United States, you know, once you, you know, with time off for good behavior and all that other stuff, they're going to basically serve a third.
No, I have a feeling, first of all, if these guys get any prison sentence at all, they better watch their back, because say what you will about those that are in prison in the United States, they've got their own little moral and ethic code. I'm not going to tell you I agree with it, but that's the reason that certain criminals, when they hurt children, rapists, pedophiles, they don't usually survive too well in prison. And I'll tell you what, these guys get any kind of sentence, unless they're in solitary, they're not going to see the sun again. I have a feeling that our own judicial system inside the walls of a prison will take care of them. But that's, you know, we can only hope for the best. I think that as the investigation progresses forward, we will find that these three knew a lot more than what they're being charged with. And nothing says that other charges can't be added. What bothers me is they did the exact same thing with these three as they did with Jahar. And that was them, the Miranda rights, way too soon. What happened to the Patriot Act? What happened to the fact that we could just lock you up and throw away the key and you don't have a right to an attorney? This is terrorism. And
that only applies to American citizens.
Oh, right, yeah. Well, let's talk about the fact that under law, they have 48 hours in which to read them the Miranda rights. And during that time, if they got from a judge, they can write the arrest warrant in a way where they can read them the Miranda rights at any time thereafter. That 48 hours can be extended indefinitely. Does not mean they still would not get a civil trial. And this is what people need to understand, because that's the big argument that we're hearing from these pundits and experts on these lamestream media shows. Oh, well, they had to do it within 48 hours. No, they didn't.
As long as they were getting good intel, they could keep going.
They could keep going with a judge's signature and still have them tried the way these liberal kumbaya nuts want them tried in a civilian court, because they could be Mirandized at any point after that 48 hours. There's no law that says once the 48 hours passes, you can't be Mirandized. You know, the whole thing is bullshit. And now you've got these three, you know, let's play pronounce that name game, who are obviously well aware. Here's my first question. And I said it before the news broke about these three being arrested. I said it over a week ago when I saw the picture of Jahar in Times Square and the news came out that Times Square was going to be their next target. They had a picture of him standing with three or four or five other guys all arm in arm in Times Square, and their faces had all been blurred out because they weren't part of the story and they were trying to protect them. The first thing I said was, those guys are in on it, and they're casing Times Square.
Yeah.
Now the picture they're using for two of the three that were arrested are in the photograph at Times Square. What a shocker. They knew about the Vaseline. They knew about the fireworks. They knew about the knapsack. They knew about the computer. But, oh, we didn't know anything.
Right. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Anyway. Getting back to where we were, we didn't even cover the Israeli news tonight. I apologize to everybody. There was some Israeli news I wanted to read. Unfortunately, we didn't have time to get to it. I want to thank everybody for listening tonight. I want to thank Wild Bill for calling in, Jenny for calling in. Rabbi, as usual, thank you. Thank you for being here.
Always a pleasure.
Mighty Mouth. And we will be back, as usual, next week. So to everybody in the chat room, to everybody listening, I am going to try and find my outro music. There we are. And we will see everybody next week. But before we leave, as usual, say goodnight, Rabbi.
Good night, Rabbi.
And Reese, my dear, who seems to be having little pin dots of blood in her fingertips from sewing. By the way, my mom used to tell me, Reese, if you're not bleeding, you're not sewing. So.
You know what? There's a lot of me on this outfit. Let's just put it that way.
don't give it to somebody that's going to have the DNA run. That's all I'm telling you. And have a wonderful night. Thank you, Reese, for all your help tonight, especially with the chat room. And say goodnight, Reese.
Goodnight, Reese.
Fighting jihad or biblical, warning of terror and Sharia rules, seeking truth to power on the radio, a lighthouse in the storm to his fellow infidels. America Akbar.